It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Up ahead, it is the former mayor of Oak Creek who was elected months before a mass shooting at the Sikh Temple of Wisconsin. Join in with your reflections on the 10th anniversary of this tragedy in our state, 800-642-1234. First, it's Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a story about a friendly debate between two beloved Wisconsin desserts.
We recently received an audience question through WPR's Wisconsin Project about two iconic Wisconsin pastries, the cream puff and the kringle. WPR's Tim Peterson was up to the task of getting to the bottom, or at least the delicious sugary middle, of what separates them.
Marissa Wojcik of Madison grew up in the Eau Claire area, regularly consuming kringle at family gatherings. Her experience with cream puff, on the other hand, is limited. Just one puff. And it did not blow her away, which prompted her to ask us,
why do cream puffs get all the attention when the kringle is the official state pastry of Wisconsin?
Well, certainly cream puffs have been a signature dessert of the Wisconsin State Fair since 1924.
Paula Hare is Director of Marketing and Media Relations for Original Cream Puffs. That's the pop-up bakery from the Wisconsin Bakers Association responsible for making and serving cream puffs for that annual 11-day run.
It is certainly the most popular and longest-running food item at the state fair. I mean, picture in your mind, you know, all of the sights and sounds of the fair and the giant Ferris wheel lights, and having your first cream puff is certainly an experience just like going to the fair. Our cream puffs are made from Wisconsin dairy-rich cream and also a very wonderful puff pastry, and biting into them is just like a little piece of heaven.
But some people push back on our very serious kringle versus cream puff premise.
Well, cream puffs are delightful. This is the most friendly debate ever.
Shauna Seaver, author of the cookbook Midwest Made, Big Bold Baking from the Heartland. She also had thoughts on the cream puff.
It's that nostalgic feel of the state fair, and it's something special that you're not going to have all the time. I mean, and it's something that's like towering and beautiful and delightful and a little over the top, and I think definitely has a place.
Now, for the official state pastry, so anointed by the legislature in 2013, here's Seaver again.
Well, Kringle came to Wisconsin in the late 1800s when there was a huge boom of immigrants from all over Europe in particular, and Wisconsin took a lot of them in, and it became a sort of landing place for a lot of very baking-centric countries, lucky for Wisconsin. And the kringle was an invention from Denmark, originally actually started out in a sort of pretzel shape, and you still find them in Denmark baked in that way. And then, like so many other baked goods, sort of evolve as they land in their new home. And like any innovative group of immigrants, they sort of tweaked the kringle a little bit for local tastes, and it's been around ever since.
We wanted to dig a little deeper, get under the crust of what separates these two. Seaver gives us a quick lesson, starting with the cream puff.
In terms of the technique, choux pastry comes together rather quickly, and you can bake it, you know, straight out of the mixer. And then you can dollop your puffs, and then they're baked off. And then when you're talking about kringle, it's actually based on a Danish pastry, which is kind of similar to a French puff pastry, but there's the addition of yeast, which gives it a little more rise and, of course, that delicious flavor. But it's a laminated dough, which essentially means that you're going to incorporate the butter by rolling and folding the dough several times. So it can be a couple-day process to make yourself a good kringle, which I think is something that a lot of us take for granted because it's something easy to sort of grab and have, you know, for coffee breaks. But they really are very well-crafted, time-consuming pastry.
And like the cream puff, kringle has a special yet different place in our hearts.
WPR's Tim Peterson brought us that story about two beloved Wisconsin pastries. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
You're with us for a special edition of The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Today is a day of reflection, a day of awareness on this 10th anniversary of the Sikh temple mass shooting in Oak Creek, when a white supremacist opened fire in the Gurdwara, the sacred place for assembly and worship. Six members were killed. A seventh victim died from injuries in 2020. Join in on how you think back to this hate crime, 800-642-1234. Steve Scavidi is former mayor of Oak Creek. He wrote a book in 2015 about how the community responded to this tragedy. Steve, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Oh, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
You were elected mayor in April of that year, of 2012. A few months later, this mass shooting atrocity happens. What is coming up for you today on this 10th anniversary?
Well, it's obviously a day of thinking back. I mean, one, it's hard to believe it's been 10 years, but I got the chance to spend some time last night with many of the members of the temple as they gather this weekend for a series of events. And it was really obviously reflecting on what happened, but I think the mood and the spirit of the Sikh community, at least the Sikh Temple of Wisconsin in Oak Creek, is that we are looking forward. We obviously have a problem in this country with mass shootings and hate crimes directed at people who pray differently, look differently. So they are committed to making their story part of the answer to maybe stopping some of these incidents from happening. So I'm optimistic and I'm hopeful along with the members of the community.
How have you changed over these 10 years?
Somebody asked me this question last week in an interview. I think it's from California. The obvious one is I have gray hair now. I didn't have gray hair then. Hmm. But the change for me has been kind of an understanding that we have to work harder in this area. And when I was, you mentioned the fact that I was newly elected back then. My knowledge of any of this, my knowledge of the Sikh community was very minimal, not very much. And I learned a lot about the Sikh religion, fifth largest in the world. I learned about the compassion and the spirit of optimism that they have. And I learned a lot just about myself, that I could deal with these things and try to be part of the answer, as all of us can, just to try to work forward on these things. And I've spoken around the country. I've obviously, I do my radio show, trying to bring this message of optimism and hope, and at least looking at each other in a more compassionate way. And I think that's the main message for me is we have a lot of problems that we have to deal with, but we also have to understand that the answer to the problem isn't politics. It's actually each one of us.
Is the Oak Creek community closer today? What do you think?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I was overjoyed to see even on this, this 10-year anniversary, I was overjoyed to see how members of the community were in such high spirits last night. And for many of them, they don't often see each other. Some of the people came from different gurdwaras around the country, and they got together last night and they will all weekend. It was that sense of camaraderie and shared story that I think was so inspiring even back then. One of the reasons Oak Creek was seen as sort of the template for how you react is because of the great work that the members of the community did with all of us, city leadership, members of our faith community across the city of all faith, our regular citizens, regular folks. They were part of that answer. And I think that's the biggest thing for anyone that deals with something like this. You have to understand everyone has to be involved. And that was the part that worked for us.
Right, because, the research tells us that the long-term outcomes for survivors of mass shootings are improved with the help of strong communities, help of community connections, and continued access to mental health support. Can you describe those community connections you see at work in Oak Creek?
Well, one of the things that happened pretty early on is we were able to cobble together a lot of different resources, and some of those were mental health, some are the governmental, all the way up to the White House, to give us the resources to help people. And we had a lot of face-to-face, and I've talked about this before. Every day for probably the first two or three weeks, a group of about 20 or 30 people, temple members, law enforcement, city leadership, community members, other faith leaders in the city, got together and talked through things so we understood each other. There was no misconceptions, no misunderstandings. And one of the answers for survivors and members of faith communities, obviously we had our shooting, Tree of Life Synagogue. I saw a short film about that last night in Pittsburgh. They're dealing with the aftermath of their shooting. We have to understand that resources must be devoted. And when I hear politicians talk about this, they often say mental health. But what has to follow that conversation is the funds for mental health. We're starting to see that, but we need a lot more. And I think that piece of it is one of the big, I think, areas where we can really make a difference.
Steve Scafidi with us, former mayor of Oak Creek, now host of a radio show on WTMJ. Join in on what comes up for you about the Sikh Temple massacre 10 years ago, about mitigating hate crimes in houses of worship, on what your community has done to build trust and understanding. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show with a focus on reflection, with a focus on awareness. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's 10 years to the day after the Sikh Temple mass shooting in Oak Creek. The governor ordered flags to be flown at half staff today to remember and honor the 7 victims who lost their lives to a gunman, an avowed white supremacist. Join in on where you've seen change, where you've seen resilience, breakthroughs in your community to build understanding, less hate. 800-642-1234. Steve Scafidi was mayor of Oak Creek from 2012 to 2017, wrote about his experiences with this tragedy in a book published a few years after, and he stays with us. Steve, I understand the mayor of Aurora, Colorado, called you on that evening of August 5th, 2012. What was that conversation like?
It was surprising because obviously a very long day, and I'm back at City Hall, and I had just talked, actually, it was amazing. Another amazing story was the President of the United States called and did what presidents do. They offered their all the help of the U.S. government. But as I sat in my office, one of the people that worked at City Hall said, we've got a call from Steve Hogan. He's the mayor of Aurora, Colorado, and I had never met him before. And he had reached out on his own. Now, if you remember the 2012 year, the Aurora shooting was a couple of weeks before our shooting, followed up, of course, by Sandy Hook later in the year. Mm. He on his own initiative, he called me, and all he wanted to do was offer advice. And it was simple advice. He said, we have just gone through this. And he basically said this: reassure your community. Speak to what you know. You're not a law enforcement professional, so don't venture into that area. Just be confident in what you know, the facts as you know them, and reassure your community. And those simple words of somebody who had reached out to me on his own, found out where I was, and that probably 10-minute conversation was a big source of my inspiration for how I dealt with this tragedy in the weeks ahead. And he has since passed. He died from cancer a couple of years ago. But I got a chance to meet him a couple times at the U.S. Conference of Mayors. And another interesting story, many of us who have gone through this, Jonathan Rothschild, who was the mayor for the Gabby Giffords shooting, Ron Rordam from Blacksburg, Virginia, which was a Virginia Tech shooting, we actually sat down for lunch together and kind of talked through some of this stuff. So the inspiration and leadership of other mayors who had gone through this helped me on my way to kind of deal with this as a very young mayor, as I said, only like 4 months on the job when this happened. So it was extremely helpful.
I would imagine, because mayors and the police chiefs, they're always the ones who are in front of the cameras, up at the podium, behind all those microphones, trying to find the right words, trying to be, as you said, clear about what had happened. And I imagine in that kind of crisis distress, you're not resting. What is that experience like in those hours and days about your role as an elected leader?
It's not easy, and I know that there's handbooks now. I participated in some of those projects to kind of help mayors work through this, but there wasn't a handbook at the time that I went through it in 2012. It's very stressful. I had the support of my wife and my family. That was very helpful. You don't get much sleep. You drink a lot of coffee. I think in the first 2 weeks, we did something like 150 different interviews from international to national to local. radio and TV. It's extremely fast paced and hectic. But when we did speak, and I had the benefit of working with a police chief that I had grown up with, we lived in the same community, we knew each other for a long time. That ease of relationship, that comfortability with each other, helped us be really clear and concise whenever we spoke to the media. We were consistent on message. When leaders get in trouble, police chiefs or otherwise, is when they are not clear, when they are not concise, and they kind of go off script. That's the worst thing you can do. It's if you stick to the facts as you know them and calm and reassure your community, that goes a long way in kind of moving things forward, which is my new mantra, basically. We have to think forward, not backwards.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the role of a mayor after a mass tragedy like the 2012 shooting at the Sikh temple in Oak Creek. Steve Scafidi, former mayor of Oak Creek, wrote a book in 2015 about how the community responded to the tragedy. Still time to talk for you, 800-642-1234. Steve, you're doing a roundtable of guests who will talk today about the impact of the Sikh temple shooting. How do you want to focus this type of conversation? What will that be like?
So I'm spending the entire 3 hours of my program today with the principal people involved that day from law enforcement. We have James Santel. He was the U.S. attorney for Southeastern Wisconsin on that day and for the weeks and months ahead. We will set up the information for people that, you know, because 10 years is a long time and people forget the details. So we'll set it up for my 10 o'clock hour, which is two people that were directly impacted. One, Pardeep Kaleka, whose father, Satwant Kaleka, was killed he was the temple president, mm-hmm. was killed on that day. And then after that is Lieutenant Brian Murphy, who was the first responding police officer, shot more than a dozen times. Even he says he probably should have been killed, but because of his incredible training and experience, he realized that he could save his own life and slowed his breathing while he was bleeding out. And it's a tremendous story. So that part is to look at those stories and to tap into the positiveness of both Pardeep and Brian, given all that happened that day and how they've reacted since, talking about this with community groups across the country in their own unique ways, to kind of shape this conversation. The key word, and you know this as a broadcaster, is always communication, talking these things through so people understand each other. And I always say this whenever I give a presentation on the shooting or my role in it, is it's hard to hate somebody that you've had a conversation with. Hmm. It's easier to hate somebody you don't know, right? It's just somebody that you see. But once you've established that link, it's much harder to hate somebody. And that's what Brian, that's what Pardeep, myself, others try to do is tell the story and tell it in a positive way, even when a tragedy is involved. And I think that's the key part, because communication was the beginning of the answer for our community.
Houses of worship, though, are havens, right? They're meant to be places of shelter, peace, where strangers are welcome. And now you see faith leaders all over the country really having to evaluate what their security is like and how open they can really be. What approach have you seen the Sikh temple take in this area?
One of the understandings and the realities of post-August 5th, 2012 is that places of worship, because I brought in all the faith leaders from our community, which at the time I think was 25 or 26, understanding that as much as they want to have open doors, right, that's always what faith is about. Welcome to our place of worship. Welcome to our faith. The reality is they have to be aware of what's going on, and security is part of that. Always have your eyes open. Be aware of what's happening on social media. Be aware a connection to law enforcement, which didn't exist prior. That is something that many places of worship now tap into. They communicate with law enforcement. If you're a good police chief, you are visiting these places of worship in your city. That's how you establish those relationships. And that understanding, that connection, I think goes a long way in at least making the members of these places of worship feel safer. Nothing's perfect, but I think that's the beginnings of, in a lot of different venues, not just places of worship, is the security piece. And that is the reality that has changed since our shooting and many others.
Steve, thank you so much for joining us.
I appreciate you taking the time, Kate.
Steve Scafidi is former mayor of Oak Creek. Ahead this hour, we speak with a geographer who studies public memorials after mass tragedies. How do you commemorate victims and horrific events? Join in 800-642-1234. News update is next. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Sikh Temple of Wisconsin is holding a series of events through the weekend to remember the victims 10 years ago today. Seven Sikh worshipers lost their lives during the hateful violence in a house of worship. A candlelight vigil set for tonight. A community event will be held tomorrow, and that includes interfaith conversations. It includes workshops on turban tying and, of course, honoring the lives lost. Join in, 800-642-1234. Ken Foote is a geography professor at the University of Connecticut, where he directs the Urban Community Studies Program. He researches public memory and commemoration in geography and landscapes and is a Madison native. Ken, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks, Kate. It's nice to be back, even if it's just a virtual interview today.
Well, the Oak Creek Memorial, and you're familiar with it, there are photos of the victims lining a wall in the temple. There is a bullet at the entrance to the prayer hall and a small, small plaque directly beneath the bullet hole, and it reads, "We are one." What do you think of these memorials at the Sikh Temple of Wisconsin?
So I think these memorials are very important. And they're a very important part of both grieving the victims and remembering them. And it is true that in many cases, these memorials emerge spontaneously, but it's not always the case. Even in some of the situations where there have been these awful killings at churches and temples and so forth, in some cases, people find it very difficult to return to the site and may actually even tear down the building and remove it from the community, because the memories are so raw and so difficult. I sympathize with what happened at the Sikh temple 10 years ago, in which I could join in some of the memorial events today as well.
What impact do memorials have on us and the way we think about a mass shooting?
I think these memorials are very difficult, in part because they cut two ways. In one sense, I use the term sanctification to indicate that people really have a need to honor the victims or to remember them. And so there is a sense that something should be done to really honor them, and oftentimes at the site of the tragedy. On the other hand, there is a sense that these are such awful events people would like to forget. They don't want to be reminded of what's happened. I say that oftentimes these events lead to this obliteration, trying to remove the evidence. So these sites, I think, are always in tension between that desire to remember or honor the victims, to do something for the good of the community, and the tension of trying to remove that evidence and draw attention away from the killer and so forth. And so that tension remains for years and years and years. And no matter how much maybe the family members or the congregation would like to honor those of the community that were lost, there's always just kind of a razor edge between honoring the victims and calling attention to the killings themselves. And so this tension, I think, remains even when we try and provide that kind of event that helps the community overcome the tragedy. There's a very difficult tension involved in that.
Well, looking a little bit more deeply on that tension over years and years, some memorials, they're created decades after the events that they're referencing. Is it a very different process to attempt to create a memorial when the pain is still so real and so fresh. What does time do for memorial creation?
The time element is actually very important, because in some cases it's very difficult to sort of sort out the meaning of a particular event, how it's impacted the community. In the short term, we have maybe spontaneous memorials or something like that. But oftentimes it takes a long time to kind of assess the impact. And so the anniversaries are very important, like this 10th anniversary. Oftentimes decisions about how to memorialize events are made on anniversaries like the 10th or the 25th, particularly at about 30 or 50 years, when one generation is passing the memory on to the next, that there'll be an effort to try and do something to make sure that that memory of the event is not lost. So the timing is actually very, very important to this. And I would also say that over the last couple of generations, there has been a change in the attitude toward these kinds of events. If we went back a generation or two, events like these mass killings that we're seeing so frequently were considered to be so shocking and shameful that I would say that obliteration was more common, that the people didn't want to have the reminder. And if the memorial was going to exist, it would be at the burial site or the site somewhere away from the event. But over the last generation or two, there's been a sense that no matter what the event was, that there should be something done for those who died. And so we see these memorials much more commonly now for events that might not have been memorialized. And that's true of a lot of the, sadly to say, a lot of these mass killings in the last generation.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about public memorials across Wisconsin, the nation, on this anniversary of the Sikh temple mass shooting. Ken Foote is a geography professor at the University of Connecticut, specializes in public memory and commemoration, studies it in the landscape. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Ken, let's acknowledge your geography, because how does the memorial change based on whether it was a mass shooting at a school or a church or a movie theater, a grocery store? How does the site of the tragedy affect what we will see there in the form of a memorial?
So that's an interesting issue. And when I was invited to join your program, I looked around at some of the information that I have in my files and so forth. And I think that when these events do occur at a church, a temple, a synagogue, or public buildings, schools, and so forth, there is oftentimes a little bit more of an effort to create some sort of memorial on site. There are lots of these sorts of mass murders that occur in houses, in off location sites that aren't so public. And I think partly because these are sites that are public, that have a community, they're the center of a community, after all, the church and the city hall and so forth, there is a sense that something should be done for the community. I was thinking even last night of the 16th Street Church, the Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama, the bombing in 1963, and those four girls who were killed. There was a memorial. There is a memorial there. They're remembered at the church. And because it was such a blow to the community, it was almost spontaneous that there should be something done there. So I think that having it happen here in Oak Creek at the temple, that it really does push that effort to memorialize forward.
You've been looking around Wisconsin as well about how mass tragedies are memorialized. You've looked at the Camden murder, for instance. What have you seen as you look at other tragedies in Wisconsin?
So that tension exists in other places. One of the sites that I looked at early on years ago was the Ed Gein murders up in Plainfield. Mm-hmm. So he's a serial killer, and beyond. It was a horrible set of crimes. And people were upset that was calling attention to their community there in Plainfield. And eventually his barn and home were burned down after he was incarcerated. And so that sense of shame that was attached to him did lead to a kind of a chance to obliterate or face the evidence of the crime. In Crandon, I believe the house where the shootings occurred was torn down. And last I looked, there was a memorial garden planted there for the victims of that shooting. So in that case, there was that sense is the house should not be kept because there was no way that they wanted to have that remain in their community. So there are these cases where there is this tremendous tension, and it's resolved by trying to remove the evidence of the event.
University of Connecticut geographer Ken Foote studies sites of trauma around the country, here in Wisconsin as well, how to remember and pay tribute to lives lost. And through this lens, we commemorate the attack on the Sikh temple a decade ago and hear your thoughts on how to mark a tragedy, what happens to a house of worship that has taken steps to heal over the years after the mass casualty attack. What does a memorial look like to you? How should it speak to a community? 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Stay with us here on The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Memorial events continue today and through the weekend on this 10th anniversary of the mass shooting at the Sikh Temple of Wisconsin. The theme of these events is called Heal, Unite, Act. Join in on what those words mean to you 10 years after Oak Creek. 800-642-1234. Ken Foote is with us, geography professor at the University of Connecticut, where he studies the role of place in memorializing tragedy like this one, and stays with us. Ken, you've studied living memorials. Can you explain what a living memorial is?
So I think it's important to point out that we oftentimes think of physical memorials as the outcome of these, but even those memorials are really the center of celebration of anniversaries and so forth. But through the years, people have also developed this concept of living memorials, of trying to promote remembrance through scholarship, study grants, travel, opportunities to bring people together. The ones that I think about is that after the Lockerbie bombing, back in the 80s, many students from Syracuse University were on the plane that went down in Scotland. I think it was about 35 students coming back from their study abroad program. And in the aftermath, Syracuse University created a Remembrance Scholar Program, where they matched students on scholarship with students that were lost in that tragedy as a way of trying to continue the remembrance of those members of the community that were lost. Harvard's famous Widener Library is actually a tribute by a mother who lost her son on the Titanic. Hmm. And so the idea was not to just end with a permanent memorial on the ground somewhere, but to do something that would lead to remembrance in the future. And I think that those kinds of living memorials can be very, very effective and very, very touching because of the way that they carry the memories forward.
There have also been hundreds of stewardship groups across the country that have created living memorials in response, yes, to the 9/11 terrorist attacks. Yes. And I'm wondering, what have you learned from studying those types of 9/11 memorials?
That 9/11 was such an important event. It's hard to summarize because it affected the whole world, wholly all in the United States, and it affected the sites that were most directly impacted by the killings. And so I think that the efforts there have been really quite impressive, to visit the shrine in New York, or to go to Shanksville, or to visit the memorial at the Pentagon. You really get a sense of the impact that event had on the United States, and it is really like the largest set of memorials that I've seen to these kinds of killings. So I don't know in the future how those will pan out, whether through time people will have different assessments of the consequences of 9-1-1, but I think that they really have set a kind of a standard for some of these commemorations.
I learned that the Forest Service has this Living Memorials project, and it's this initiative that brings the power of trees. Trying to bring more trees into these living memorial sites.
Yeah.
What is the impact of trees in particular?
Well, trees are a symbol of life. Mm. So it's no accident. In many cases, you get into the symbolism that's used in these memorials, and it's the trees is a symbol of community and tree of life. The flowing water, the circle is a symbol of community. These come up. And that idea, I hadn't heard about that, but it is a very nice idea. There's also, for example, in the Netherlands, there has been an annual commemoration of people who've died of cancer. And, you know, people who die of cancer aren't typically the subject of this commemoration. So in the Netherlands, they started having an annual event where the people who lost family members to cancer go out and plant a tree. Mm. They're planting forests for the cancer victims. And so again, it's the use of trees. In Canada, they have a lot of lakes, and they've actually named a lot of lakes after the soldiers who died in the wars. Mm. So there are other ways, I think, that are quite creative ways to remember either battlefield losses or events like the ones we're talking about today.
Earlier this week, U.S. Senator Ron Johnson introduced a resolution commemorating the 10th anniversary of the attack and honoring the seven victims. And he had introduced a similar resolution at the one-year anniversary of the Sikh temple attack. How meaningful are Senate resolutions like this? How meaningful are words?
I think those resolutions play a part in this, but I would say that it's the government action that comes later that can be very, very important. But what I mean is that in many cases, these shrines, these memorials start off as a local effort by the community that was most effective. And because they're very important, sometimes they grow in importance, and that importance shows up with funding and legislation by other agencies. The case I draw attention to very often is the Martin Luther King death site in Memphis, Tennessee, because the first shrine for his shooting there at the Lorraine was by the owner, Walter Bailey. And Walter Bailey said, this is really important that we mark the site of Martin Luther King Jr.'s death. Mm-hmm. And through the years, Walter Bailey and other members of the community were able to argue for support by the city of Memphis, by the county of Shelby County, by the state of Tennessee, and eventually by the national government. So at each stage, they were generating interest and support to do more at that site because it was so important. So it may be that Johnson's efforts there will help to generate attention and call more attention to the losses in Oak Creek. But these initial resolutions oftentimes are just at the stage of getting the discussion started.
We're talking about memorializing victims of mass tragedies like shootings and murders, weather events. Ken Foote is a geography professor at the University of Connecticut, where he studies commemoration in geography and landscapes. You can join in on memorials that have moved you, memorials you visited, and what you think of them in terms of mass tragedies like shootings. 800-642-1234. Ken, the 9/11 memorial in New York City, as you referenced, it cost hundreds of millions to build and $63 million a year to operate. What role does cost have in these memorials?
In some ways it has a lot to do with the way that we remember these events and the amount that people are willing to invest in them. And I think it does raise the issue of you know, what designs are right, what are best for the occasion, what's the suitable amount to invest in these memorials. And I certainly have opinions about some of the places that I've studied, but I think the main thing is that it has to be up to the community to decide. And in the case of something like 911, it isn't just the folks who died that day and their families, but this event was such a major blow to the United States and to countries all around the world that many people were touched by it. And so it's no accident that it's become such a substantial memorial, because people were willing to invest the amount of money. But I would also say that in many cases, as I travel around and visit and talk with people, and sometimes I'm really struck by how very humble memorials, very small remembrances, can have a really deep emotional impact. And I'm always struck sometimes in going back and visiting some sites, maybe a school disaster or so on from 75 or 100 years ago. And I go and I find maybe just a small plaque or something, but it's very clear that people are still visiting. They've left flowers, they've left remembrances, that even these humble memorials can be very, very powerful as a way of reminding people of what they've lost and the people that they might once have known.
When I think of humble memorial, I think of the Sikh temple and that yes. That bullet hole with the three words, "We are one," right under it. That might be an example.
Yes, I think that's a perfect example. It's very, very powerful. And to visit some of these sites, you can just see that it's such powerful emotions are brought up just by being there with the evidence of what had happened. It really is very, very striking.
In the last moments we have together, you brought up tensions about how memorials go forward. And I'm wondering if you have any advice for the Oak Creek community and for houses of worship in terms of where they go forth with memorials when they have different ideas of how to do it.
I think the debate that occurs after these events is really very important. And there's no predicting what direction it will go. But simply the debate, simply discussing this, is very important, because, say a generation or two ago, people would have shut down that kind of discussion entirely and said, no, we'll do it at the graveyard. Because that means that people can talk about how they feel about these events. And so opening that up for discussion, I think, is a very important part of the overall process of grieving, of dealing with the lingering effects of these events. So I think that's one of the things. And from what I was reading about the events in Oak Creek this week and through the year, I think that the community has done very well in trying to remember those who are lost. So I think that these efforts are very important, and they're doing the right sorts of things.
Ken, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Ken Foote is a geography professor at the University of Connecticut, studies how and why Americans memorialize the sites of tragic and violent events. Stay with us as we continue our conversations on the 10th anniversary of the Sikh temple mass shooting. We have a member of the Sikh community and anti-hate advocate, and the work of hope and healing with an advisor to a survivor retreat. Join in anytime with your reflections, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.